Hello and welcome to Devon Dice Presents, a review of Android Netrunner. I am your host, Joel Wright. I am joined by my co-host, Tom Westrope.
Hello, everyone.
And we have a special guest in the third seat this evening, and that is Oliver Brooks.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on.
No worries.
Oh, no trouble. Did we get you a nice comfy seat?
It is actually relatively comfortable, yeah.
Note that down. Third seat, comfy.
In this podcast, every month, we will be taking a game and looking deep into the box and its contents. And why not? Every man in his meatball doing a game review these days. We've decided to do our first reviews all based on the top 10 games found in Board Game Geek website. And FYI, we locked down our top 10 in November 2015 because we always knew the positions would change over the course of our plays, and also the order suited us much better at the time. The rules to our reviews are as follows. We will play the core box only, the one you can pick off of a shelf. No expansions, promos or variants. We will play as many games as we can take of it and in different environments as possible. And we will give our honest opinions about it. The review copy for this review was provided by Joel from his own collection. This is a work in progress and we will fine tune it as we go. Good or bad, we look forward to any feedback you want to give us on any of our content we produce. Let us know via our Twitter or Facebook page. Links can be found in the show notes and the website devondice.co.uk. On with the review.
Welcome. Android Netrunner is a two-player living card game set in a dystopian cyberpunk future where monolithic corporations control the vast majority of human interests. The corporation works to advance its agendas, while a subversive hacker known as a runner attempts to access and steal those agendas. To win the game, each player needs to score 7 points from advanced or stolen agendas. But from there, the corporation and runner's methods diverge. Corporations seek to score agendas by advancing them, which costs both clicks and credits. To buy the time and earn the credits they need, they must secure their servers with powerful security programs called ICE. ICE comes in different varieties, from simple barriers to aggressive sentries. Runners need to spend their clicks and credits to acquire the tools of the hacker trade, installing the necessary hardware and icebreaker programs to run past the corporation's security measures. Filled with calculated bluffs and high-stakes hacks, Android Netrunner allows you to change your reality one run at a time. Welcome to the future. Welcome to Android Netrunner.
So coming in at number 10 on our list, which currently is number 11 on the Board Game Geek Best Games, is Android Netrunner. It's been pipped to the post by Star Wars Imperial Assault, which is number 10. The game is designed by Richard Garfield and Lucas Litzinger and published by Fantasy Flight Games. Richard first designed it in 1996, calling it Netrunner, and released by Wizards of the Coast, it was a CCG, a collectible card game. It was then sold to Fantasy Flight Games in 2012, and they put it into their Android universe, hence the Android Netrunner. It's a two-player only game, broadly, but there are three and four-player variants. We didn't play any three or four-player games, we've just reviewed it as a two-player game only. You can play it in about 10 to 45 minutes, so it's quite a variant in length, depending on how well one side or the other does. And the main setup of the game is that this is a living card game, which means that you can buy packs of expansions which have specific cards in, and you know what cards are going to be in those expansion packs, which means that if you're new to the game and you're going into the full deck building experience. You can decide what your deck's going to be by looking at all the variety of cards online that there are and then buying only the packs that contain the cards that you want. And currently there's 33 expansions available and they're being released regularly.
Expectations. So we're going to go and look at our expectations of first coming into the game. I mean, from my point of view, I have already been playing Android Netrunner up until about a year ago, where I picked up a core set and a load of expansions for quite cheap off of someone, and then went straight in headfirst, trying to deck build and play the game from there. I think I was in the middle or at the beginning of the second cycle, which is basically what happens is the core set came out, they released six tiny expansions and then a large expansion, and then they go back through again and do six more small. So I came into the middle of the second run of that, and I remember like most of it from playing and experiencing the game like that. When we came to sit down and play this, I think I completely forgot all the rules and had to refresh myself and just polish up. And then it was almost, it was a new learning experience, and it was different because I hadn't experienced some of these cards because I just delved straight into deck building and almost picked a couple of characters and that I wanted to just work on and focus on. But now playing the core set, or looking forward to the core set, it's like, okay, I get to experience it all and each one, how they work.
Well, I'd never played the game before. I've not been into, not really kind of got into the world of collectible card games or living card games at all. So this whole thing was a new experience, and I was looking forward to seeing what a complex card game like this, totally bespoke, could offer.
The components. Let's first focus quickly and simply the components. So we got the box. It's a great big box, and in it you get a lot of cards and components. So thoughts initially then on the component side then?
Oh, they're good, aren't they? I mean, you say it's a big box, and I think that's fair. It's too big. It's far bigger than you would need to have to fit all that stuff in it. But they're I think it's a game that's deep enough to be worthy of a big box, if you know what I mean. And certainly it gives you that space for your cards if you're going to collect them later on. In terms of component quality, cards are a really good, high quality card. Didn't see that there was any issue with kind of wear or bending, you know. That so really nice cards. Obviously, if you played it a lot, you'd naturally get some wear. So I was really pleased to see that, and the arts and graphics is and graphics on the cards are also really nice. Really get you into the theme of the game. Count all the counters, really good quality, look good, and so thumbs up for the component quality. There was one thing I was going to say. Oh, the only thing was that it took me. this was more my fault than the game's. Was you shuffle in common cards into the deck, and then you have to take them back out again to put them into a different deck when you want to play with that other faction, and I struggled to tell which ones were the common cards and which ones were the faction cards when you were separating them back out, because they're all slightly different color and then the common ones are gray, until I realized that there's a little symbol in the corner of the cards down in the bottom right, which you can use to know which faction they belong to. So that was a little oversight for me, just a small little thing, and nothing to do with the gameplay really.
Yeah, I mean, it's Fantasy Flight, and Fantasy Flight produce a good quality game. They always have good quality cards, components, or tokens of very good thickness. Like I said, it is a big box. For what you get, I mean, if you put it all together, you would take up less than a fifth of the box with all the components. But they use a big box to get shelf space and to kind of, when someone's buying it with their eyes and that, it's like, oh, it's £30 box, look at the size of the box, it's pretty good, but there's a lot of cards in there. I mean, you get almost seven decks. I say that because they are really tight on how many cards you get. They're just enough to make decks. And like Tom just said, there's neutral cards which are shuffled between each decks. So yeah, if you want to change a character, a runner, you have to take those neutral cards out to add into the next runner. Where I've experienced with other games, other card playing games, they've give you a plenty of cards to make decks up, and they just sit like that in the box. So it's Fantasy Flight's normal way of doing things. They just give you enough to give you a taster, and they also expect if people are going to get deep into this, you're going to buy more than just one core box, because if you want some extra cards, like there's only one card of something in it, where there'd be lots of cards of another thing. So if you want another copy of that one card, you got to get another core box. So that's just another kind of money wrangling way I see it for Fantasy Flight. It's like, well, we'll just give them enough. Just give them enough of this card. Say, right, if they want another one, they've got to buy a core box, which is cheeky, but it's how they work, and no one else really kicks up a fuss about it. So
no, and it probably brings the price entry point of the core box down initially for that initial first box.
I don't know. I think it's just cards at the end of the day, and if you're printing a lot of cards, there's not going to be much discrepancy in the cost. Yeah, in sheets and things like that, but as I remember it, it is just them saying, yeah, we'll just give them enough to do the minimum with, and they expect you to buy 2-3. I mean, when I first saw it coming out, I saw people picking up 4 core boxes of it so they could have enough cards to play around with, which is at 30 quid a pop, that's a nice bit of money.
How do I play, Joel?
So yes, we're going to go on to the rules, and this next bit is going to be rules explanation of how to play Android Netrunner. Rules of play. So here is the rules overview of Android Netrunner. There's quite a lot to explain, and I will try and keep it as simple and as quick as possible. That's not to say I might miss stuff out or not explain stuff. Please do not take this as a rules play for you. This is just an overview. To give you a quick idea of what happens. Android Netrunner. It's a game of two halves. Basically, two players will sit down with their own deck of cards, and one will be defending, the other will be attacking. That is as simple as it. You both play to different rules and different strategies. You both got one goal in mind, to score 7 points before the other person. Points come from agendas, and the only person that has agendas is the corporation. The corporation has to spend time trying to build these agendas and make them fully fledged and funded, where the runner can just steal them from under their nose. Each player will choose which side they're going to do, either corporation or runner, and the corporation will select an identity card and a deck to go with that identity. The runner will do the same, select identity, character, and select a deck with that. Also, with the core box, they have to take the neutral cards for that side and shuffle it into their deck. They have to shuffle well, make sure it's well mixed up, and then they both place their decks down. To start the game, they will both collect 5 credits from the credit pool. This is their money, and then they will draw 5 cards from the top of their deck. If they're not happy with the cards they draw, they can mulligan it. This basically means that they can take the cards that they have, reshuffle them back into the deck, and draw another 5 new cards. This can only be done once. Once they're both happy, the game will begin. Now, starting with the corporation always goes first. The corporation will place their deck down. This becomes their R&D. This is where all the information is and where all their projects are. They will place their ID next to R&D deck. This is their known as their HQ. And it also represents their hand, their server for their hand. Next to the R&D is another invisible stack for the time being. It's called the archives. This is where all the cards that are discarded and trashed will go. So that's the 3 central servers. These are always there. Next to the HQ will be remote servers, which aren't existing yet. The corporation has to create them. At the beginning of the corporation's turn, the first thing he has to do is draw one card. he always has to draw one card. He gets three actions to do play on his turn. These are known as clicks in Android Netrunner. Out of these three clicks, he can draw more cards per click from his R&D. He can collect a credit from the bank per click, and he can also install cards into servers. He can install genders, assets, and traps into the row beside R&D and HQ. This is meaning these are remote servers. These are always face down, as well as ice, which are placed in front of any server that's there. He can create a remote server with a piece of ice to represent this is a new server that is there that can be run on. Ice is also face down, along with upgrades. Upgrades are placed in the root area behind all servers. Ice and upgrades can be placed on any server that is there, if I've not said that before. Agendas, some assets and some ice need advancements. Advancements cost a click and a credit. You bet the corp will basically take a credit from their own pool of credits and turn it over and place it on the card that they are advancing. So this indicates it's been advanced once. They can do that as many times as they got credits and clicks left, and they can do that over numerous turns. The agendas need a certain amount of advancements before they are scored. Once the corp reaches a certain number of advancements, they get to score the card without using an action. They basically reveal the card, showing it to the runner that they've scored it, place it in their score area, and maybe, sometimes, it will trigger an effect. The effect will go off, they will benefit. Sometimes they can just score the card without triggering an effect because it doesn't represent anything. Other cards use a res cost. A res is basically, they reveal the card and they pay a certain amount of credits needed to res that card. They can do this at any point in their turn or the runner's turn to turn to reveal this card and pay the cost. It's usually done with ice and upgrades. To res a card, the corp needs to be to reveal the card, turning it face up to pay the res costs in the top of the card. He can only do this if he's got the money, and he might not do it because it doesn't take effect. He can do this at any point in his turn or the runner's turn, and it doesn't cost an action to do this. The other card the corp can play is operations. It's basically like an event card. He pays the cost in credits in the top of the card, and it happens. There is another action the corp can take, and that is removing bad publicity. If the corp's got bad publicity, and I will come to that later, it can pay a click and credits to remove it from its vicinity. And that's the corp's play. They're basically playing cards all face down, playing a poker style game, trying to outwit the runner, make him run on servers he wants him to run on to trap in, and not run on the other servers where he's slowly building up his agendas. These take a while to build, because sometimes they will need up to 5 advancements and the corp only has 3 actions to take. But if he's got 5 advancements on it and he scores it, it's usually got a good payoff and it's usually 3 points, which is almost halfway to winning the game. Normally, in the first turn, the corp will want to protect its R&D because R&D at the beginning of the game has most of the agendas in the game and not give the runner an easy time on running on his servers. So on with the runner. As I said, the runner and the corp will select an ID, and if I haven't said this before, each ID comes with a special ability. Also with the runner, it also shows how many links that it has. Links will come into later, I'll explain that then. The runner will shuffle his deck and place it face down, creating his stack, it's called. He'll draw 5 cards like the corp player, and this is called his grip. It also has a discard pile, which is called the heap. The runner will get 4 actions to play on his turn. Actions are called clicks. Each click, he can draw a card from his stack, or he can gain a credit from the main pool. He can also play event cards from his hand, which are like operation cards. They are paid for and played immediately, and he gains the benefits of it. The runner is trying to run on the servers, trying to win the agendas from the corp. The trouble is, the ice will cause the runner problems, so the runner has to build a rig suitable to match corporation's server powers. The rig will contain 3 types of cards. It will contain programs, hardware, and resources, resources are almost ongoing effects or extra actions they can take. Hardware is pretty good. It will really upgrade the player or upgrade programs, give them more memory or more links or more credits to use, something like that. But programs are the main thing. Programs are there to help them combat the ice. Some programs can be there to use as actions to gain more stuff, like draw more cards or more credits, but mainly they're used to combat the ice. There is several different types of programs. So the other action the runner can do is make a run on the servers. He can run on any server that has a card in it. If he doesn't come across any ice and there's a card in the main server, he can reveal that card. But if he comes across ice, usually on the first run it's going to be face down, so the corp has a choice to reveal it. If he doesn't reveal it, it usually means he can't afford it or it won't benefit him or affect the runner. If he does reveal it, then he's res in the ice, he has to pay the res cost, and then it's turned face up. Runner has to deal with that piece of ice. There are four types of ice. There's traps, there's sentries, there's barriers, and code gates. To combat the ice, the player has to have the right programs to affect the right ice. There are fractures for barriers, killers for sentries, code decoders for code gates. There's also AI programs which can fight all of them, but usually either cost a lot or they usually have a very high cost or weak benefit or need time to build up. You've got the program, you've come across the ice. Now the ice will have a strength. This is how strong that ice is, and your program has to match the ice, so the name has to be the counterpart to the ice, and it also has to match the strength. Some ice give you the option to pay credits to up the strength for the program, and then if you can match the strength of the ice, you then look at the subroutines. Now each ice can have a different number of subroutines, ranging from 1 to 8 maybe. You can combat any of the subroutines in any order you like, and you don't have to combat them all if you don't think they affect you. Basically each pro give you a cost to combat each subroutine, and you have to usually pay a credit to combat the subroutine to make it not go off or activate. You do those in any order, and as I said, you do not need to do all of them if you don't need to. Once you've done what you wanted to do on that ice, the corp then goes through any subroutines that are not being deactivated, and they will trigger if they can. You then move on to the next ice or move on to the main server, at which point you can jack out, but usually you want to stay in. If you make it through to the main servers, you can then reveal the cards that are in the remote servers, and if there's any agendas there, you score them. If there's traps there, they do damage. And if there's assets there, you can usually trash them for a cost. If you reach the HQ, you get to draw a card randomly from the player's hand. Again, score, trap, or trash. If you get to R&D, you can reveal the top card, score, trash, or trap. And then there's also archives. Most archives cards will be discarded face up, but if the card's never revealed when they're trashed, then they will be face down, so you can access all cards in the archive and again score any agendas in there. Traps don't usually go off and you don't need to worry about trashing. Also, if you've accessed a server and there's upgrades in the root, you can access those as well and trash those for cost as well. The subroutines that you got to worry about really are ones that trash your programs or do you damage. That's usually net damage or meat damage. That's usually you discarding cards from your hand randomly. If the runner has to discard more cards from its hand than it has, the runner will die and lose the game. There is also the end run subroutine, which if you don't combat that and deactivate it, you literally have to end your run and you can't go any further. There are also trace subroutines. This usually comes with a power X, power to a number. The corp can up the power by spending credits. Then the runner has to match that with links and credits as well. If he can't match the trace, then the runner becomes tagged. If the runner is tagged on the corp's turn, the corporation can pay credits and an action to discard resources in the runner's rig. Now I said that the corp can get bad publicity. This is handy for the runner, because if the corpse got bad publicity, he will gain a credit per run per bad publicity. So if the corporation has three bad publicity, the runner will get three credits to use on each run it does, to use to strengthen its programs and combat subroutines. Also, another thing the runner can do is pay a click and credit to discard tags it's taken on. And that's basically it. Whoever gains 7 or more agenda points in a game wins a game. You got the corporation that's playing all its cards face down, poker style, trying to outbluff the runner, make the runner run on the servers it wants it to run on, and not the servers it doesn't want to run on, or possibly try and do him enough damage to kill him off. Runner is trying to second guess what the corporation is doing, run and find those agendas. It also can try and drain the R&D of the corporation, because if the corporation's R&D stack runs out, it's game over for the corporation. That's hopefully basically it in a nutshell. I probably missed some stuff. As I said, do not take this with as a proper rules explanation. This is just a rules overview.
Well, that was interesting.
Okay, so that was the rules explanation. Tom, how do you find the rules of Android Netrunner?
What do I think of the rules? Okay, I think the rules are... This is quite a difficult place to start, actually. The rules are brilliant in that they set up a lovely, complex, interesting game, a nice space upon which two players can go at each other. But they also create quite a high barrier to entry. It's a strange learning curve, this game. And one of the reasons for that is the complexity of the rules, and moreover, and specifically, the amount of words that have specific meanings. So it's card game. All the cards have text. All the words and text that are on those cards have specific references to your hand is called a specific thing, and it's different for the two different players. Your deck is called a different thing for the two different players. And all of that all coming together means that you're constantly having to be on this journey of learning what all those different rules mean.
But the complex of the rules, how did you find that? I mean, I think sometimes you found it a bit tough, didn't you?
I didn't mind the complexity of the rules. I understood the rules when they were explained. Learning the game is different to understanding the rules. Because to learn the game, you have to know what the cards are and what they do. And to do that, you either have to sit down and read through all the cards, spend an evening reading through all the cards to know what's in there and what they can do. Or you learn by playing around with that set of cards. And as they come out, you kind of understand what they're going to do and how they're going to operate. And both of those two things come with different benefits, which come on to later. Again, as part of that learning curve, really is the big thing I'd say about this game. But in terms of the complexity of the rules, they're not that hard. I mean, you get income, you put your cards down, you use your action points effectively to trigger them. I don't think the rules are that complicated. But getting the tactics and the way in which you then use those rules to best win, that's obviously a different thing, which I did struggle with.
I mean, I remember I actually read the rule book front to back and still didn't know half the stuff that was going on and was still quite confused about how to make a run on any server. And I would sit in many Tuesday evenings with like Ollie and others and play and have them, okay, explain this again to me. And they were like, well, you got to do this and this. And I was like, oh, okay, now you make it sound simple. And then I'd try and play another game. And I was like, I still don't get this. This is way, and then it wasn't until like we were playing it that I get it now. This is actually quite clever, and enjoyed that aspect of it, kind of thing. I mean, I don't know about you, Ollie. I mean,
well, certainly learning the game for the first time was relatively interesting because I have got a background in playing a large number of card games, so. For me, picking up things like, as Tom mentioned, the terminology, so the different names of things, that wasn't so much of a problem because you just sort of collate those things in your mind. So you're like, okay, HQ is the corpse hand, that kind of thing. So it's also thematic for that terminology. So you can sort of go, okay, I'm running on a remote server. It kind of makes sense. The actual rules themselves, though, yeah, if you're sitting down to play for the first time, especially on your own, I would say it's probably fairly tricky. If you haven't got a large amount of experience with those kind of games, that you'll actually struggle. It's not necessarily a game I would say sit down, read the rule book from start to finish, and suddenly you understand how to play. It is one of those ones where you probably need to sit down with another player, both of you sort of go through the first sort of few turns in a play out, sort of like, so okay, I'm going to do this all open so everyone can see what's going on, to sort of get a better idea of what each of those actions means, how they're going to interact. And then once you're comfortable with that, as Tom rightly says, you can then move on to the deeper complexities, like the tactics and sort of knowing the cards and when to make runs and how to use that in a very sort of surgical and bluffing side, depending on which faction you're playing.
So I would argue that going into this game expecting, so having played other card games, you're probably expecting to have to spend a bit of time before you're going to understand what all the terminology means.
Oh,
and
yes,
you're okay with that. And probably a little bit quicker at picking up too. I think the important thing for anybody who's thinking of acquiring this is be aware that that is going to be part of the learning experience before you understand this game, will be learning what those things are. And it's not insurmountable. It isn't a single reason why people shouldn't play this game or shouldn't get this game, but it is something that I would warn people about, and they should be aware of before they decide to get this.
Oh yes, certainly. Yeah. Don't pick this up from the store shelves going, oh, this looks cool, I've heard something cool about it, and go in completely blind and expect it to play like a regular board game with nice simple rules or something like that. If you've got no experience with this type of thing before, it is an uphill climb, but for some people, the competitive aspect of it and the nature that it's asymmetrical really holds a big sway. That was one of the big reasons why I looked at it, because it was a re-release of an asymmetrical card game, and there aren't a lot of card games that have asymmetry in them. And so it's a good example of that, and makes you think both how you're playing and your opponent's playing.
Yeah, and you probably covered this in the rules, Joel, but the asymmetry is not just in that you have two decks that are built differently and do different things and are built around different strategies. The actual rules are different for the two sides asymmetrically. So, that's really interesting for me, and I totally agree. That's a big draw in. It's really exciting to be able to effectively play two games. You're deciding when you're deck building or when you're going into it, what are your strategies going to be for when you're playing as the corporation, and then you're doing the same as the runner, and you can be good at one or the other. And when you sit down against that other person, you're experiencing that game in those two different ways. Which brings us on to deck building. Joel, why don't you run us through how deck building works with this core set?
How to deck build.
Okay, Tom, if I have to explain how deck building works in Android Netrunner, I will. I'll try and give the quick overview of it. So to deck build, like any other card game, there's some restrictions and there's some rules you have to follow. You just can't chuck any cards with anything. You can't mix corporation cards with runner cards and vice versa. You have to pick an identity. So either pick a runner or a corp. And usually when you're playing in tournaments or anything like that, you want to pick one runner and one corp you want to work on. You pick an identity for each of them. Now, as I said, each corp can only have corp cards incorporated, and runner can only have runner cards. Neutral cards, you can have as many as those you like in each of those, and affiliation with that runner or corp. Now, you're allowed to take a certain number of cards from different factions into your deck. It's restricted by the identity card you chose. Normally about 15 influence points are allowed. That's not 15 cards. It could be if you've got cards with low influence, but it's how much their influence totals throughout. So you could have a few cards that have 3 or 4 influence on it, and you can put those into your deck. It really restricts you of how much you can mess around with just a core box. Also, if you're playing with the corporation, you have to have a certain number of agenda points to how many cards are in your deck. The minimum with most of the core decks is 45 cards, which means you have to have 20 to 21 agenda points. It's all set for you when you take the starting decks out, but when you start deck building, you've got to bear that in mind. If you start increasing your deck size, you've got to increase the agenda points value within the deck. Also, you're only allowed to have 3 copies of the same card. So you can have any number of cards in your deck, but you want to keep it small because you don't want to be trying to hunt through those cards you want. Remember, you can only have 3 cards. With runners and corps, you can have out of faction cards in your deck, but only to a certain number of influence points. The influence points can be found on the cards in the bottom right hand corner. Just need to look for the pips. And you can have any number of neutral cards in there as well. And that's it really. You sit down, you pick a character, corp and runner, and you work with that. If you like one, you work with that one. You take cards from somewhere else and you add it into that deck. Remember, don't break the 15 influence points. And you keep trying stuff out. You try combos, you try different strategies with the cards, see how they go. You can also go online and find lots of info from forums and other internet websites where they put out different decks that they've built, and try those out.
So that's how it works. I think if you're getting this game, and we're reviewing the core set, if you're getting this game, it's not really there for deck building. There's not enough in this in a single core set for deck building.
Mm-hmm.
It's good to give you a flavor of how the game plays, whether you might enjoy it, whether you want to get into that bigger world of deck building and where it will really come into its own. But you're not going to be able to do a lot of it. But there's a lot you do get in the core set. You get 4 corporations and 3 runners. So there's a lot of content. There's a lot of gameplay that you can experience just in that core set. You can play it a number of times, as you know, and as has been pointed out to me before. You know, you can buy other board games, play them a few times, and you know, only a few times, you maybe you won't get around to playing them again. Whereas, you know, this is, you're constantly exploring, or the board game, maybe you've played it a few times and you understand it all. You understand all its tactics, you understand all its depth, and you know, that's fine. With this one, it's more of a learning experience. So don't expect deck building in the initial game, but certainly that's something that's there as a little teaser for if you want to splash out the cash to get into the bigger thing.
I was just going to say is that when I started playing Netrunner a year or so, probably 2 years ago, I jumped halfway in the middle. So I had all these decks and everything to go by, and I just tried to pick something I like. But now playing it like me, how me and Tom have played it, just with the core, and just playing as the runners as they're meant to be and the corps as they're meant to be, I found it, okay, I understand now what this corp is meant to be and what they're meant to do, and I understand how this runner works. And if I probably started from the beginning, or when I jumped into it, just done core running with someone else, I probably made it understand a bit more, and I don't know, maybe got my skills a bit more tuned, I should say, and then start deck building from there. But I jumped in quite late and then tried doing deck building straight off the back, and it didn't really favour me that well.
Yeah, something that I was going to say for that both you made points there, that the deck building aspect is the long-term play out and payout of the game. It is the thing that if you're really seriously into it and you really enjoy it and you like what it does, you'll go down into that deck building hole, essentially, that is you'll meet up with the people who you regularly play with and you'll build a deck, you'll play against each other, and then you'll go away after the games and you'll think, oh, how can I beat that? What can I do to change that? Oh, I hadn't thought of that combination or whatever. And you'll naturally play off of each other and get better both at the game and the deck building aspect. And that's the sort of the long-term payoff. But if you're coming into the game fresh, you can ignore that to some extent. You can know it's there and that there is that long-term ability, but it's not for everyone. Some people are happy with just the experience they get from the core set. Some people don't want that complexity of the deck building and the competitive nature of it, whereas they'll just stick with the core set and have their fun. Because even though you might not have the most varied sort of deck building choices in it, there is a lot of replayability, as you mentioned, from that core set. And I would certainly say anyone who wants to get into the game, get with the core set, start with the core set, don't jump straight in at the deep end, unless of course you're feeling like you've got the experience and the ability to do so. But if you want to just sort of pick it up, as Joel said, and learn what it's all about, it's a good start. And then if you feel you've got a good handle on the reins, then jump in.
So let's move on to actual plays experience of this.
So I think there's an overarching theme in everything that I want to say about Netrunner, about all the different, you know, about the rules, about the experience, start experience, and about my experience actually playing it. And that is that learning, it's that journey you go through with someone else, and or not, and how fun that is. So my main experiences of the game, to start with, they were playing against you, Joel. So you'd had some experience of it. You knew some of the things that were likely to come up. You had some concept of the strategies and things like that, and that meant that I was obviously on the back foot in terms of those games and likelihood of winning and ability to kind of compete, I guess. But not, you know, as you say, you hadn't really played with the core set, and so there was still this mutual learning. You know, we were still finding our way through what was actually in the decks, what the different strategies were going to be. And really my experience at that point was that you would play through the deck. It would be kind of interesting whether or not you were able to kind of on the fly deal with something that cropped up, because I hadn't read any of the cards, didn't know what any of them were about. But mostly then the experience entirely changed on the second or third playthrough of those decks and that runner and court, because you knew what the deck had in it. So that's kind of one set of learning where you're constantly jousting with each other. The second type of experience was playing with you, Ollie, and I asked to have some additional games, get some games in on Tuesday night, and thanks for that.
All right,
and you've obviously got very in-depth knowledge of both the core set, how all of the different tactics and the minutiae of how the mechanics of the game work together. And we spoke about this at length and, you know, increased my understanding immeasurably through that. But it meant I was getting smashed around for, you know, and those games we played, and I'm glad you did, because I wouldn't ever want anybody to hold back against me. But what was weird is that I never really felt as though I understood why I was being smashed around. So during the game, when things were happening, I didn't really understand, okay, I know I've lost. I know it's because Ollie's played better than me. I can't see what I could have done differently. I couldn't feel my way through those kind of larger tactics. And then we'd discuss it, and you'd kind of say, oh, well, actually, this is why it happened, or this is the kind of tactic that happened in that situation. And I'd pick that up, and I'd kind of effectively learn from the knowledge you were then passing to me. But it was interesting how I was experiencing that learning in a different way when I was kind of jousting and we were both kind of learning together, Joel, and then kind of almost not learning by playing the game. I was being shown the game and then being taught what had happened, which then I could apply. That's
quite funny, because I had to bite down on my tongue for that, to not actually try and say, Tom, you can do all of this, while I was playing.
And then the third experience, which I'll just sort of go on too long before letting someone else in, is I showed another new player how to play. So a friend of mine was down, and I thought, right, let's crack this out and see how quickly someone else can pick it up, how much they enjoy it. And interestingly, that again was always going to be more akin to my experience with Joel and I, but I was more in a situation similar to how what Ollie was in, but not probably in as big a gap of knowledge, which made for an interesting gameplay. And it meant I could see the game from a different place. And I think when you're playing as a better player or a more experienced player, you can, that allows you another way of seeing the game and another avenue for being able to understand it. And you see things that you wouldn't do while you're either jousting with someone or you're smashing someone around, because you're employing these tactics, but you can see why they're vulnerable and you can see how the other player's not responding to it because they're not aware of how to respond to it. So that's my play experiences. I felt quite so they're the play experiences. I'll say how I feel after everyone else had a go because I've been talking for too long.
I think when playing with you and just playing with the core box, as I said, we got to learn each corp and each runner differently and how they work. But then we also had the experience where, like, we would play a couple of games as one corp and one runner, and then we would swap. But because I've been playing the corp and I've seen most of all the cards that were in the deck, and then I became the runner, I kind of knew, well, there's not much he can do to stop me. I'm just going to take a risk and run on R&D. And you had one ice there.
Which is your draw deck.
Yeah. And he had one ice there. I ran on it. He flipped it over. And it's basically I lose clicks, which is action points. And I basically, okay, yeah, I'll use up my clicks to get through certain stuff.
Any of the Byroids have pay a click to break one of their subroutines. So if it was you're running on your first click, you probably hit something like an Itchy 1.0 or a Heimdall 1.0 or something like that, yeah. Because they're quite staples in the core set.
So Itchy is basically the first two sub-routines is basically just trash a program. And then the third one is lose a click. Oh, no, it's not.
It's trace one, take a tag, and do a brain damage if successful.
That's not the one I'm thinking about. One of I was thinking about was... it trashes, it's two lots of program trashing and then it's take a tag, and I would just say, okay, I've got no programs, I had nothing on the board really, I put nothing down, I get some money in and I was like, right, run on that and I'll lose a click for not taking a tag, that's fine, and then I'll look at his R&D, and out of that game I didn't put any programs down, I didn't do anything. I probably put down a resource or two, which I didn't really need to. And then I just kept him running on his R&D because he wasn't putting ice out to protect it. And I basically...
didn't have any.
Yeah. And I basically just won it from going on his R&D and his HQ, which is his hand, and got all the stuff out of that. I think Tom Prattley threw the box at me then. It was just like, that's just unbelievable. But he did turn it around where he did get out enough ice and stop me. And then I was having to get programs out. And by the time that also, when you start getting enough programs out, you can basically either have enough money or enough clicks to keep working through. And that's particularly on that corp, which is the HB corp. And then that's different to when we played against Jinchecki. We both learned that. Okay, we got to be careful because there'd be a snare or a trap in there where we'll lose cards in our hand. So we've got to have enough cards in our hand to try and run on it and not get caught. And if we do get a agenda out of it, we've got the cards there to just protect ourselves so we don't die. So we were then preparing ourselves for that. Okay, draw, run on that. Okay, we've got through, it's fine. And that's how it kind of felt. We just, well, now we know the decks. We know how to play. Is it too, I don't know, too easy then afterwards? And that was kind of our plays, really, just playing with the core box.
And certainly there were moments of just utter desperation, weren't there? It's like, without that full knowledge of exactly how everything worked and what all your options were, not rules-wise, but tactics-wise, you really felt as though there's just nothing I can do. This deck is just playing itself. It's been set up for me, and it's just playing itself once everybody knows what's in them. And that's quite difficult. And there were some moments, I think, where we both got quite frustrated with that, and it became. It felt like it was stale in that there was no room for a game around those decks. There was no room for us to actually continue playing with some of those decks as I say,
and say that's where the deck building then comes in.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Essentially, the idea of the core set is to teach you how to play the game, get a good enough experience from it so that you've had your money's worth from the singular core set and you've had your experience. But if you are really interested in taking it to that next level and you're like, well, I actually want to now make it so my opponent doesn't know what's in my deck, that's where the deck building really, really shines.
Because of course, you know, and exactly what we're saying is that once the decks are set and you know what's in them, you know exactly what they're all about and you know what you've got to watch out for, everything else, and then they play themselves. But once you're deck building, you can know the breadth of all of these cards that are available if you've read through them all and spent the time to learn them all, or all the likely ones. But you will never know exactly quite how that person has decided to set their deck up. Have they put that card in there that they'll just be able to kind of just play and do some damage to you? Have they put the snares in? Have they really done that? Or are they just going to pretend that they've got it and kind of play like they've got it? And that is where it comes into its own, that later on stage, where you're using the game and the rules to feel out what the other player's likely to have put it, or, you know, how are they playing this? What's going on? And then you're having to switch gears or change your tactics or whatever based on how you're playing that. Now, I haven't done that yet, but I can certainly see that there's a lot of game in here to explore later on. Is that right, Ollie?
Yeah, definitely. There is a huge, wide, well, across the entire world, big competitive scene where deck building is the only way you're going to be able to get one up over on your opponent. And you need to make sure that if you're playing at that kind of high level and you understand all the tactics, you understand what moves you can make, it's what surprises can you pull for your opponent? What can you play that will throw them off guard? What can you do that will make them second guess themselves? Because a lot of the game is bluffing. And it's, am I playing this card? Am I not playing this card? Am I actually putting this agenda down? Am I making credits to put some big icebreaker down? What are you doing? And it's trying to gauge your opponent while also gauging their deck that really is the key part of that wider game. And it can make all the difference. There was a big tournament locally recently that I played in, and I played a card that it was just a meta call. It was something that at the start of the day, just before the tournament, I went, you know what, I'm going to change one card in my deck. And it turned out to be one of the best changes I'd made. It helped me beat two of my opponents. And it was a card that most people wouldn't normally play in their deck. And it was just because I thought, well, there's a lot of this sort of tags going around, so I need to deal with it. And I put this card in, and it turned out to pull its weight in gold, basically. It helped me no end. So it's little things like that, like little decisions like that, that your opponent isn't necessarily going to think about, that can completely throw them off kilter and just mess with their game plan, and then that can help you get the win.
I mean, it's said before, is the core set is great for starting off, but once you know the decks and once you know which one to, the game kind of bottoms out a bit. That's how it kind of felt
with the core set.
Yeah, with the core set, it's just like, well, there's not much we can do. We know how they each play. It's only going to be a chance that if we carry on playing, it's going to be a chance. Okay, we're going to get a lucky run. Each person's either just going to become lucky. They're going to get the cards that they want. Either the court's going to protect themselves very well, or the runner's just going to have a good chance of running quickly on the corp and getting what he needs.
I think the best player is going to win. Yes. More often than not. But it certainly feels, in playing it, it can feel like a luck fest. It's probably is in reality less luck based than it feels. But certainly when you're playing the core set, once you know what's in them, as those first mid experiences, once you've got the rules but you're getting the tactics, it certainly feels quite desperate and luck, and you kind of don't feel like you've got a way of dealing with it. But Ollie's going to tell us that you can.
Yeah, I'm going to just say that in the core set, no, you're right, is, and part of that is due to essentially a concept called variance, which is that it is, because there's a lot of the cards in the core set are what they call one of, which you only get one copy of. So As well as some cards which you only get two copies of, and other cards which you only get three copies of, and there is a limit of three copies of card in your deck. So if you're looking through a 45 card deck and you're looking for one card out of 45, then yes, you are going to be feeling like there is a large degree of luck, because there is, because you're essentially trying to find one needle in a haystack sort of approach. Again, that sort of goes away as soon as the deck building comes into play, because if you get into it and you put more than one copy of a card in your deck, or you include more cards that do a similar job, such as making money, you include more than just the standard three or four cards, and you include cards from other factions, then you're going to notice that you're going to be more likely to find the thing that you want, and that makes a big difference.
One of the interesting things, and on kind of a side note here then, I guess, is also, and this is a concept you I kind of was aware of, but you kind of phrased really nicely, Ollie, when I was speaking to you a couple of weeks ago, that there's, I've played quite a bit of poker, Texas Hold'em poker back along, and that has very simple rules. Anybody can pick that up and play the game, and the better people will do better because they understand the odds a bit better. They know when to play, but a lot, so there's that. But there's also bluffing.
Yes.
And you described that as social bluffing.
Yes.
Which is an interesting term, where you're kind of, and I've experienced that on tables of poker, and I can see how it works here, where you're kind of feeling the table, you're feeling how things have gone, you're understanding how people are viewing you as a player, and using that knowledge to then play a bluff in that scenario, in that circumstance, by getting the other person to... by getting into the head of what the other person thinks you're likely to do and twisting that on itself. But there's also, what was the other one you said? You called it social bluffing and game bluffing or something.
Yes. So
where you were kind of just using, you weren't actually social bluffing, you were just using mechanics of the game more so to bluff.
Yes. So Netrunner's quite clever, especially on the corp side, in that because the runner doesn't necessarily know what cards I've put down. A classic example is doing what they call naked scoring, which is basically you put an agenda out, which is the thing the runner and the corp both need to score or steal to win. And you put one of those out in a remote, no eyes protecting it, nothing on it. You just put it there. And the runner has no way of knowing what that card is, unless they run it or they play a card or they do something to interact with it. And you see it quite frequently, not all the time, but quite frequently, someone will do that, especially early on in the game when they're feeling out their opponent, and their opponent won't run it, and then next turn they'll just score it. From then on, the opponent is then immediately wrong-footed and will start running every single thing that you put out, and you can use that to your advantage. So that is a good example of using sort of the expectations of the game, but also the mechanics of the game, to try and bluff your opponent in an effective fashion to allow you to get the win. And you could also do that with traps like Snare. I've seen people do that before, put out both agendas and snares, and then people run, they see the agenda, they think, oh, maybe they've done something else, or they see the snare, and then they stop running. And you can change how people interact with you based on both the game mechanics and how you're playing the table.
So there you go. So that's a bit on this, how this, because this game's been described as poker with cards, although I would argue poker has cards, but it certainly has some relationship in the type of thing that's going on. It's not betting, but it is bluffing. It does have that kind of feel of you've made your move and you sat there hoping the other person doesn't work it out because you're hoping to bluff them. So that's quite nice. Quite like that. I still think poker's a better game.
Okay, with that then, we'll move along. And likes and dislikes. Tom?
Likes and dislikes. Okay, we've probably talked about this quite a lot already, so I'll be brief. I like the concept of the game. I like the asymmetry of it all. I didn't enjoy some of the desperation I felt while I was playing it, and it felt like it was... I had no control. And part of that is to do with the big learning curve, which I didn't mind, but it I don't mind spending time learning about the game, but it certainly takes some time to get to know all the cards. And actually, by that point, you probably have used up your experience of the core set.
Yeah, mine are pretty similar. I mean, I'd like the asymmetrical play. Your one's attacking, one's defending. They've both got different rules. I love that. It's great. You don't find that at all in lots of games. And I like how each one's got their own kind of character. Each deck's their own character. What I don't like is just the core box itself. As we said a lot, you play it and then that's it. You get to you mellow out. You know the decks, and you can't really deck build with just one core box. And even if you brought a second core box, I don't think you can really do much way, because you're so limited in how you deck build with just the elements you're given. And it's that whole thing with Fantasy Flight. They give you the literal pure basics of what you need in a core box just to get you started. They tease you and they say, here's a game. But if you want to get more out of it, you've got to spend more money with us. So you get literal basics. And then I've picked up different games like Ashes and Versus, the new one. And Versus, they give you four cards of everything. And you can pretty much deck build how you like with that. In Ashes, they give you six decks, full decks. You don't have to shuffle between cards. It's all ready. And then you can pretty much, again, deck build with in any way you like it. Mix it up at all. There's only a few little restrictions with that. But with Netrunner, as I said to Tom, oh, maybe we could deck build with this and just have a go at that. And then I thought about it. It's like, it doesn't seem like we'd be able to, because you're so restricted in how the deck building works. So we kind of just said it's not really worth it. We're not going to get a lot out of doing that.
Doing deck building with the core set is what you mean.
Yeah. Deck building with the core set. I mean, if we were going to go full blown with this and say, right, let's get on with this and do this, then yeah, we'll buy expansions and we'll experiment with that. But I haven't got the time to do that anymore. That's why I jumped out of it a year ago. And I say, Tom, you probably wouldn't have the time or...
No, all the money. Probably put that money into the board games. I mean, you mentioned a couple of other the kind of deck building type games there. I would argue that I think Netrunner is probably a better game than those ones, just in my opinion, of those two. But the base games of those two are better than the base game of Netrunner. So I think that the system of Netrunner is better.
Yeah.
If you're in it whole hog, yes, better. The game's better. It's got more bluffing. I like it more. Ashes is a bit more like Magic. You build your deck and then it plays out. There's less of that kind of metagaming and bluffing and interaction. I don't think it's as good a game, but I would enjoy, if I had to pick one base game over the other base game, I'd probably pick Ashes as a base game over Netrunner as a base game.
I've got far more plays out of Ashes, just the core box, because there's nothing else out yet than I would have had with Netrunner. Because Ashes, I'm still playing with the same starter decks, but they're just so good that, like, battling each other, and you've got a chance of still winning. You know what your opponents might have in their hands, but it still works quite well. Well, as we said time and time again, you play the core set, the decks are this, and...
But do you think that Netrunner... which one do you think is the better game if you were going to get into them in deck building properly?
Well, Netrunner, because it's got much more material behind it.
So let's... and we're going into hypothetical world here, but let's assume that there's as much material was brought out for Ashes, and you're then just looking at the systems once you're in a world of deck building with all those options. Which is, do you think, is the better system and gives the best game?
I probably would say Netrunner, because you've got the two different sides. You've got the attacking and the defense, so you've got to build two decks. You're playing two different games, and I like that. That's a nice thing. I mean, with Ashes, in a way, it's good, but you're kind of restricted because you're restricted on the dice you roll. It's a dice game at the end of the game, and if you don't roll good dice, you're going to struggle through that. So, but
yeah,
that's it.
Ollie, what are your likes and dislikes on it?
Netrunner specifically on the core set, As someone who has played competitively, I dislike the fact that you only get one or two copies of certain cards, but I understand why they've done that, because it does mean you get seven factions, four corp, three runner to play in the core box. So, because obviously you can't include every card, and if they included the three copies of every card, it might overwhelm and you'd get weird deck compositions and stuff. So I understand why they've done it. So as a competitive player, I would say that's probably my dislike. But actually on the light front, I like the fact that it allows you to learn everything you need to know, sort of the basics of Netrunner, enough that you can feel very, very competent in the game, and then take that knowledge that you've learnt, and regardless of what new cards might crop up, that knowledge is still relevant.
Cool. So let's roll on to then, Ollie, this is why we mainly brought you in, because you're deep into it and just breathing out of a straw at the minute. Expansions and...
Give me the snorkel. or scuba gear, yeah, suddenly going down that far.
So I think I counted up 33 expansion packs.
Yep, got every single one of them.
Now, how do you deal with that? I mean, you must be a guy.
I'm gonna turn 180 degrees and look behind me and see the piles and piles and piles of deck boxes and cards and folders filled. I've literally just spent the last 2 days beforehand reorganizing my entire collection so I can find what I'm looking for a lot easier.
I mean, when it first started coming out, I mean, there was a big gap between the first expansion pack and the core box, wasn't there? And yeah, I remember
I think it was about 4 months or so.
Yeah, that was really long, and people complained about that. But you, I remember you came into the shop when we were there, and you picked up, I don't know, another two core boxes and like three of these expansion packs just to see. And I was like, why? Why are you spending all that money on it? You go, well, I want to experiment. I need enough cards to experiment. I was like, oh, you just blow my mind, you do. I mean, do you still do that now? Do you pick up three packs?
Not anymore. No. There's a couple of reasons, mostly to do with own personal cash flow. But the other thing is that the main reason is actually they have announced rotation for the card.
Right.
So it's going to be, it's 2017 or something like that when the rotation will happen. So, and it's going to be a slow rotation. I understand why they do it. It's so that it doesn't become stale, because if you have a game where every card is legal forever, then you kind of run out of ideas as a designer. You kind of go, oh, well, we've already printed a card that makes 9 credits. So if we make one that makes 8 credits, no one's going to play it. So, So it really hems you in as a designer as to what you can actually print later on, and like interesting ideas. And if an idea didn't work, you might want to change it and repackage it up in a different way and see if it works better the next time. So I can understand why they've done it, but that's another reason why I switched to only buying a single. But yeah, originally I did it because I wanted to experiment, and I often have 6, 7, 8 decks aside built up. Mm-hmm. Just because I wanted to try the massive, massive variety of choices that you have in the game, because you've got that core base, but there's so many directions you can go in, and you can emphasize certain play styles over other. You might go all in on the bluffing, or you might remove the bluffing entirely and just try and make it a catch-22 situation. Or yeah, there's so many different ways in which you can play, and that experimentation was what really sort of drove my initial excitement for the game, that and the asymmetry.
So the rotation then that's coming out, it's basically when that starts happening, the old stuff's dead and you got to start.
Well, it is, the old stuff will go out, and it will be the first, I think they're doing it in a two, what they call cycle. So every 6 expansion packs that they bring out, the little mini, like what they call data packs, each 6 of those actually forms what they call a cycle. So Genesis, Spin, Luna, so on and so forth. And then they've got the big boxes, sort of not the core set size, but things like Data and Destiny and Creation and Control. And those won't cycle out. Those are cards that they consider to be staples of the game. So okay, they're not cycling right. those out. So it's just the like six mini packs that are in those blocks, and it will be the oldest two of those. So for the first rotation, it will be Spin and Genesis that will go. But as I said, that's not going to happen until 2017. So it's even in the competitive scene, even though competitive players know that, they're still like, it's like a whole year away. So it's not something that they're really thinking of at the moment.
What it also does is it lowers the boundary to people who want to get into the competitive scene.
Yes.
As things cycle out, they don't have to worry about even looking at those.
Correct.
There'll still be a whole bunch of load to look at and to decide what you want to buy them.
That was a problem with FFG's other LCGs, in that because they kept a lot of things in, I think it happened with Call of Cthulhu, I remember seeing someone turn up with four big folders worth of cards and went, yep, this is every card up to about 4 years ago, and I've got another four of these at home for the last 4 years after that. And it's just like, and you have to look through that every single time. You have to know that entire card pool.
It's unmanageable, isn't it?
Yeah, at that point, you might as well look at Excel spreadsheets and do something like that, because that's the kind of thing it's going to be. Mm. Whereas that rotation is going to mean that if you want to get into the game, you can start with a core set, pick up the faction box that suits you. You like Criminal, pick up Honor and Profit. You like Shaper, pick up Creation and Control. And then that way, you can then pick up the little packs that you want. You don't even need to pick up all of them.
I mean, I know a guy done that, Tony, at Tuesday Nightclub. He literally done that. He says, I want to play NBN. Tell me what I need for NBN. And he said how I want to play it. So then someone went off and looked through everything and came out and said, well, you need this pack and this pack and this large box and you're sorted. And that's what he's done, and he's got a horrible NBN deck to try and fight against, because it's just constant give you tags and then
kills.
Yeah,
I've played against Tony's deck. It's for someone who hasn't got all the sets, it's a very, very scary deck to face.
Yeah.
So it might not have the variety of the larger card pool, but so once you've played it a few times, you might know what's coming. But it certainly packs enough of a punch to
So there is a way to mitigate it and say, okay, this is what, as you said, I like this runner in the core. What do I need to make it better? And someone could probably tell you, okay, get this and you'll be fine.
And finally, our verdict.
So let's get on with the final verdict. We can probably guess what Ollie's is.
Should we start with Ollie?
Two thumbs up, 11 out of 10. would play again.
Exactly what we thought. Yeah. Tom, your verdict on the core.
My verdict on the core is it's a brilliant game. Go in, if you're thinking about buying the core deck, do it knowing that you are doing it as a step towards that bigger game. Know that there's a bit of a barrier to learning it and a bit of a step to getting up there and being able to understand it properly, and try and get someone who knows Netrunner to teach you the rules and help you understand some of the basic tactics once you've, you know, played it a few times with someone that you're learning it with. Would I recommend the core set if you know that that is the only thing you're going to buy because you know you aren't going to be getting into the deck building? I don't think I would recommend it. And that's a shame, and I hate to say it, because I think the overriding point, which is why I'm going to finish on it, is that Netrunner creates a brilliant game system. It creates a brilliant world that you can interact with and deck build in, but you just don't quite get that in the core set. Do get the core. If you're thinking about getting into the big world of deck building, do get the core set first and play the core set out first. Don't skip straight to the big deck building world. That's the only other thing I'd add.
Yep, exactly. So yeah, my opinion same. It was same as yours. The core set is fine to learn, but you will get to a mellow out point where it's like, okay, I know what happens now. And it kind of, we both sat there in one game and go, I'm kind of bored of this now. I know what I'm doing. It's not really doing anything anymore. And yeah, if you're going to get into the game, get the core set. Learn those first. Learn each character's abilities and what they're good at doing. Learn the core, what they're all about. and then go off and talk to people. Like Ollie's on Netrunners UK on Facebook, aren't you, Ollie?
Yeah, I'm on there. There's a whole bunch of guys on there. Yeah. There's loads and loads. There's so many groups all over the place.
There's loads of forums about it. There's Facebook groups galore. Go out there and talk to them. I'm sure they'd be quite welcoming to say, yep, go here, do this. This is what you need. If it's just for you and someone to sit at home and play regularly or occasionally, it's going to bottom out. So I couldn't recommend really just doing that. And then I suppose it's something I just thought of. Tom, the verdict, should it be in the top 10 of Board Game Geek? Is that too hard a question to ask?
I think it's fair to have a place in the top 10. I think it stands out for me as probably the best LCG system game that I'm aware of. And because of that, I think it's good to have a variety of different types of things knocking around in the top 10. Insofar as using the top 10, other people using the top 10 as their order that they're going to get into gaming. They don't know how helpful that is, but it's definitely, I think it's fair, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's the only LCG living card game that's in the top 10, and it's only the only two-player game that's there as well. Oh, no, it's not. I'm wrong. Twilight Struggle's two-player, isn't it?
Yeah.
So for LCG, it's the only one that's there, and because of the two different sides that you play, it's such a unique game on that aspect. I think, yeah, it should be around there. Top 10-y. I mean, it sits at number 11 as we record this podcast. It's been taken out by Star Wars Imperial Assault.
It's Plug Time, brought to you by Oliver Brooks.
And now we're going to finish up, and we're going to thank Ollie for joining us, and he is going to plug whatever he would like to plug.
Oh, well, that's good, because as a games designer of my own, I'd like to plug King's Watch, which is a game of mine which is coming out later this year. The actual release date is to be confirmed. I believe it's probably going to be Essen this year, from what we're getting from the printers. And that is a cooperative experience for 2 to 4 players where you play as the titular King's Watch, and you're trying to catch criminals, hunt down the crime, murderers, that kind of thing, and make sure that they're all arrested and put away for the safety of the city. And yeah, that probably takes about half an hour to an hour to play, depending on your players and their experience levels. If you want to find out more information about it, I would check out Wotan Games. They are the kind publisher who are publishing it for me. You can find them at wotangames.co.uk. And if you want to keep up to date with any of my other design work that I'm doing and releasing, you can find me on Twitter at OliverBrooks25.
Nice.
I'll say a big thank you to both Tom and Joel for having me on. It's been a pleasure to talk about Netrunner.
Yeah. No, thank you for coming and sharing your far more experience and skilled knowledge with us.
Definitely. I'll give it a week or two, Tom, and I'm sure you'll be turning up and wiping the floor with everyone.
if only I had the money.
Well, you can always borrow some cards. I've tempted you now.
Sold.
We've lost Tom. He won't be appearing anymore. Just be swimming in some cards in his lounge. Oh, what do I put in? So that's why we invited you on, Ollie, because we needed a better aspect look at the game. But thank you for turning up.
Yeah. That's all right. No problem, gents.
And thank Tom for turning up and playing the games with me.
No problem, Joel. And thank you, Joel, for turning up, playing the games with me.
I've got to stop treating you as a guest. I'm a control freak. I can't help
it. That's good. You're the boss, man. You're the boss.
So that's me, Joel Wright, at Depressed Monkey on Twitter, and Tom.
Tom Westrope at TP Westrope on Twitter.
And we'll say good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Or goodbye.
Or goodbye.
Bye.
Good evening.
Good
morning. Good afternoon. If I don't see you, good night. Yeah. For those of you old enough for the reference.
thanks go out to our families for putting up with our habit. Come join us and have a chat on our Facebook page at Devon Dice Presents, our guild and board game geek, Devon Dice number 2124, and visit our website page, devondice.co.uk. You can find all the show's information that we talked about in this podcast in the show notes, and there might be links as well. Join us in a month where we will be reviewing Castles of Burgundy. And next Monday, there is extra content coming out. Stay tuned for that. And in 2 Mondays' time, we will be doing our chat show again. So see you for all those. Credits go out to Jason Shaw for the music by AudioNautics.com. And the trailer that you heard at the beginning was from Fantasy Flight Games' own playthrough video on YouTube. Thank you for listening. Come back soon. Three, two, one.
Go.
Best intro ever.
Oh, I hate you.
It's because we're so late. I've drunk so much port already.
Oh, my God. You're going to be alcoholic by the time the 2 years are up on this podcast. Tom, how do you find the rules of the of Android Netrunner?
I don't know. I haven't listened to them yet.
You're a git, aren't you?
Sorry, that's...
What's... Okay, so coming in at number 10 on the Board Game Geek top 10 list at the time of lockdown is Android Netrunner. It's currently sitting at number 11, having been pipped to the post by what was it, Imperial Assault.
Star Wars Imperial Assault. Say that again.
Currently coming in at number 11, having been pipped to the post by Imperial Star Wars Assault, which... what are you laughing at?
Imperial Star Wars.
Imperial Assault.
Too much port.
So late.
It's only 10 o'clock.
I've only had one glass.
Start again. Right.
I'll start from the beginning.
Yep.
I'll stop this recording and I'll delete it. I'm going to start again.
Okay.